50 years ago, we were warned by Dwight David Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. Let's take a listen.
Fellow Americans, this evening I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
Ike made those remarks as the Cold War was just getting started. 50 years later, war seems to be the permanent condition, and the financing of those wars seems to be without limits, even while we talk about defense cuts. Today, the military-industrial complex has grown even larger than Eisenhower could have imagined, and sitting atop that complex is the largest defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, a company that's truly become the poster child for the military-industrial complex. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, William Hartung. He's the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. He's the author of And Weapons for All. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and The Nation. And it is my pleasure to welcome him to the program today to talk about his newest work, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. William Hartung, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. It really does seem that the the defining beginning of all of this was really the point at which these defense contractors realized, or these companies that made aircraft and other things for war, realized that the government could be their primary customer.
Well, yes. Really, you know, after World War II, there was a realization among these companies that they were never going to be as fat and happy as they had been during the war unless they found kind of a new rationale. And, you know, a lot of that came from the government, but the contractors pushed it along by saying, we need new bombers, we need new missiles, we need all manner of military equipment to deal with the Soviet Union. And President Eisenhower pushed back against that, and he fought the bomber lobby, he fought to some extent the ballistic missile lobby and so forth. And his experience doing that and how difficult it was even for him, a war hero, a Republican president, to really keep that all in check is what led him to give the military-industrial complex speech, his farewell address.
What did he see early on, even long before this speech, when he first came to office? What did he see that he was pushing back against? What did he sense was going on?
Well, you know, one thing that bothered him was this kind of collusion amongst military leadership and the contractors. In some cases, he would come out against a particular system, and his own generals would be speaking out of school, saying, well, we need the new bomber, we need this new piece of equipment. The contractors were even going so far, which at that time was novel, of advertising in major publications about why we needed certain systems, sort of going over the head of the president, trying to appeal to the public directly. And the beginnings of the jobs argument, which is used almost exclusively today as kind of the bulwark of high military spending by the Aerospace Industries Association and other contractor groups. So he saw that coming together, and he felt that it distorted our ability to make decisions about what we needed to defend the country, not just what was needed to keep these contractors profitable.
And it was all sort of an outgrowth, as you say, of this post-war period when these air policy boards were set up and really set up to be independent bodies, but really made up of all people that had stakes in the aircraft industry.
In one case, there was a board where every single piece of testimony was from either somebody from the Air Force or the industry. There was one conservative writer who was very close to the industry, a columnist with the New York Times, who also spoke to this group. But there was no kind of representatives of other industries or other areas of the public interest or kind of any kind of independent take on why we needed to pump up the aircraft industry at the beginning of the Cold War.
And this is something that even Truman had started to do. He had appointed a commission at one point, I think you talk about.
Yes, yes. There was kind of dueling commissions between Truman and the Congress. And in both cases, they were pushed along by key leaders in the industry, like Bob Gross, who then was the head of Lockheed, because they basically saw that without that kind of ongoing government support, they were not going to become these large companies and sustain the kind of huge presence that they had during World War II. So there was a brief moment there, which Gross described as, you know, the most horrifying, you know, days of his life, when it seemed like we were not going to have this permanent war economy, and that therefore they were going to have to fend for themselves in commercial markets, as many other companies are forced to do.
Talk about Bob Gross, because in many ways he's a key player in setting the tone for the military-industrial complex.
Well, he came into it with not a lot of knowledge of the aircraft industry. He was basically an investor, and Lockheed had had hard times. They had gone bankrupt twice. It was the beginning of the Depression. They had been bought up by this thing called the Detroit Aircraft Corporation, which was basically the automakers trying to create what they called the General Motors of the air. He swept in and got it. You know, basically he bid the same amount as the scrap dealers and got the company for almost nothing, borrowed other people's money. And, you know, he quickly saw that government was their ticket to prosperity. So not only initially it was to get contracts for the post office, then it was sales of bombers to Britain for their war effort, and then finally, you know, they went from a company of a couple thousand to 90,000-plus employees during the war buildup. And so at the end of the war, he was not about to let that lag. And so he went around giving speeches about how we needed air power to fight communism. We had to be able to go anywhere at any moment. And the way to do that was to have air transport so you could get your weapons and your troops where you needed them. And he used Korea as kind of his touchstone, but he wanted to have this sort of permanent imperial kind of overstretch, or well, he didn't view it as overstretch, sort of global reach that would keep the industry in good stead, you know, indefinitely.
The Korean War was really a huge boom to these contractors.
Well, yes. They had been making a lot of arguments. There had been arguments at the governmental level, by the industry, but it wasn't until the war started that they really got traction, and they basically were able to, you know, increase aircraft spending more than double, and then sustain it at fairly high levels after the war ended. So that was their kind of you know, stepping stone into the kind of Cold War permanent arms establishment, which in those couple of years after World War II, they were having a hard time, you know, getting traction on that whole concept.
How did the policy of containment, as it started to evolve as kind of the defining issue of the Cold War, how did that impact this?
Well, it kind of created this ethos that said, you know, more is better. You know, we've got this Soviet enemy, and when in doubt, spend more. Spend more on bombers, spend more on missiles, spend more on aircraft carriers, spend more in terms of aid to allies to bulk up their armed forces, you know, mostly aid that enable them to buy our weapon systems. So there was kind of this notion that, you know, no amount was too much in the face of this enemy whose capabilities were exaggerated almost from the beginning. You know, during the whole period of the Cold War, there was always this notion that the Soviets were 10 feet tall, when in fact they had serious flaws in their economy and in their defense systems.
Of course, there was the whole issue of the bomber gap and the missile gap in the 1960 campaign.
Which was interesting, because you had, you know, John F. Kennedy, perceived as a liberal Democrat, basically running on national security issues to the right of Richard Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president. And it was largely building on reports about the bomber gap and the missile gap that came in part out of the industry. They were sort of feeding material to their allies and government. And the missile gap in particular, when McNamara came in as Secretary of Defense, he acknowledged that, you know, these large numbers of alleged ballistic missiles on the Soviet side ended up being maybe less than 10, whereas we, in the meantime, had gone into the hundreds, going towards the thousands. So not only was there no gap towards the Soviets, there was a huge gap in our favor. And so that didn't really come out till after the election had been won. So that whole kind of one pillar of the foreign policy plank of the Democrats was based on false information that was stoked in many ways by the arms industry.
Talk a little bit about Lockheed Martin and how they began to emerge as the leader of the pack, so to speak.
Well, you know, it began, you know, during World War II because they were a major producer of fighter planes and bombers. They produced, you know, tens of thousands of combat aircraft, amounts that are just unimaginable now because, you know, of course, they're much more expensive than they used to be. But then they became a big producer of transport planes. The C-130 became sort of bread and butter for the Air Force. And then they ran into big trouble with the C-5A, which was supposed to be the largest aircraft ever built, was supposed to be able to carry, you know, massive quantities of men and equipment, but also land on unimproved airstrips in places like Vietnam and elsewhere, which it was not able to do. It ran a couple billion dollars in cost overruns, which is the record at that moment. And this is where the lobbying machine really had to kick into high gear, because they finally were, the money wasn't just flowing easily. They had critics in the Congress. They had a whistleblower in the Pentagon. They had Senator William Proxmire, who was not going to let go of this issue. And so they, at that point, had to start spending more money on political contributions. They moved, facilities into districts with people like Mendel Rivers, head of the Armed Services Committee at the time, so that he had almost a personal, you know, economic stake in making this program happen. So they, you know, not only were they the leading kind of economic force in terms of contracts, but they became sort of the leading lobbying force in terms of trying to preserve programs that under other circumstances were not really sustainable or viable.
Talk for a second about the whistleblowers, because they really were two, one that was addressing the issue of cost and another addressing the issue of quality.
Well, yeah, there was Ernest Fitzgerald, who was in the Air Force, and he had come in as a consultant his job had been to help, the Pentagon keep tabs on these companies and also help the companies themselves spend less. And he really was put under great duress by the Air Force for his role in raising those things, to the point where ultimately he was fired and he had to get a job on the staff of Senator Proxmire as kind of a fallback to keep, himself in some kind of income coming in. And then there was a whistleblower from the company who showed from the inside sort of the overruns, the way that they would have duplicative parts in different factories and just sort of double spend, how they would throw out useful equipment and just buy new stuff because all of this was being done on cost-plus contracts. And so, you know, wasting money just meant you got a percentage of waste as part of your profits. They were even doing things like putting, aircraft as if they were ready to go that were missing sometimes hundreds or even thousands of necessary parts. So it really was not just a economic scandal, but it was a scandal in terms of quality, performance, and its ability to do the mission that they claimed it could do in terms of landing on these unimproved airstrips, in terms of flying at certain rates. And there came a point where even the wings were cracking, and they had to kind of, put the whole program on hold. So it was a disaster in the making, but it took many, many years to sort out because the company, you know, had such strong lobbying force.
And there was this rush to get these planes delivered because that's when the company would get paid.
Well, yes, and that was part of the reason why you had these incomplete planes sitting there ready to be assembled, because they would cross the point at which a new progress payment would be forwarded to the company. And so there was sort of this kind of structure where they almost had an incentive to provide a shoddy product because there wasn't enough oversight in the factories. Many of the people who were supposed to keep tabs on them for the government ended up getting jobs with the company, and so therefore they were going light on them, knowing that here's my future employer who's going to pay me much more than I'm making now. I don't want to, create a rift with them just when I'm about to cash in. So the revolving door where that kind of process would happen also was, fully into play at that point. So a lot of the issues that we're dealing with now in terms of how to tame the industry date back to sort of that period of the late 50s through the early 70s when a lot of these things really took hold.
And there were some real problems with the planes themselves, problems with the C-5 and then with the commercial L-1011.
Well, the there was kind of this perfect storm, you know, that worked to the company's disadvantage. First, they had the wing cracks, the fact that it was overweight, all the different problems with the C5A not meeting its standards while, you know, almost doubling in price. And then their commercial airliner was not competing well with Boeing and others. So they, between the losses on the airliner and the issues with the C5A, they were on the verge of bankruptcy. And so they turned to the government for one of the first major corporate bailouts. Basically, Lockheed Martin and Chrysler kind of were the original kind of too-big-to-fail companies that got bailed out by the government. And they brought all the arguments to bear. You know, it was going to hurt jobs in key regions. It was going to basically bring down the entire defense industry if we didn't give Lockheed Martin this loan designed to basically bail out its management for its own bad decisions.
And then the other scandal that came along a little later were all these bribery scandals as they try to sell planes overseas.
Well, there was a link between the two because, you know, Lockheed did get the loan from the government, and then they needed to pay it back. And their only clear route to doing that was foreign sales. And so one of their VPs set up shop in Japan. He made common cause with a former war criminal and organized crime figure who had ties into the Japanese government and the Japanese, you know, airliner companies. And, you know, so he in a one trip there wrote out a couple multi-hundred-thousand-dollar checks to key players in Japan just as kind of the down payment on the bribery campaign to get them to buy Lockheed airliners. Then they had similar experiences in Indonesia, in Italy, in the Netherlands, in Saudi Arabia. In some cases, that, you know, they were so sort of cavalier about it that they, in Indonesia, they said, well, you know, the main thing here is we have to use a middleman because otherwise we can't take the bribes off on our taxes. You know, so they were just assuming the bribes were going to happen, and they were just kind of maneuvering for, you know, how even on the bribes to get the best deal for themselves.
And with the Saudis, they were going through Adnan Khashoggi, who was playing all sides.
Exactly. You know, he would work for anybody. It's like, well, yeah, I'll work for Northrop, or I'll work for Lockheed. Just give me the, you know, my commission, and I'll pass some of that on to the key players. I'll get you into the market. He could sort of get away with that because Saudi Arabia was spending so much money that he could kind of parcel out some contracts to different companies and take his cut along the way. And, of course, a lot of it made it to the leadership of Saudi Arabia. It wasn't just staying in his pockets. He was just kind of the conduit for the bribes. And if you called them commissions to Khashoggi and you hid the fact of where they were going, this made it seem more acceptable instead of just saying, well, we're giving bags of cash to leaders to buy our planes.
And a lot of this was very legal at the time.
Well, yes, really until the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the 70s, which was pushed by Proxmire after the bribery scandals, they could, you know, they basically could do this. There were issues of, you know, were they meeting U.S. tax laws or things like that. But the bribery itself was not viewed as criminal. And in fact, you know, they made that argument during the bribery scandals. They said this is just the way we do business. It's not illegal. Everybody does it, therefore, you know, why should it be an issue? And of course, it was taken much more seriously in the countries that were whose officials were being bribed. I mean, in Japan, it brought down the government. It was kind of their version of the Watergate scandal. They had, you know, televised hearings. People were, you know, like taking time off at work to watch these things. The whole country was riveted by this scandal, which in our country was just kind of a footnote, you know, to Watergate and the investigations of multinational corporations by former Senator Frank Church. So, you know, it really was almost backwards. They said, well, you know, we have to do this. It's, you know, we're getting press from other countries. But, of course, the citizens of those countries were outraged when they realized what their governments were doing and the collusion that they were entering into to spend their money, in many cases on aircraft that they didn't need.
The other aspect is that their tentacles reached into every aspect of the government. It wasn't just the military, but even into the CIA, which began with the U-2 spy plane.
That's right. The U-2 was one of their big projects of the 50s and one of their more successful projects. It did get the job done. It did do what it was supposed to do. And interestingly enough, it gave Eisenhower some information that would have been useful in debunking the whole idea of the bomber gap. But he didn't want to reveal that he was spying on the Soviets using this particular aircraft, so he wasn't able to use that information to defend himself against those unfair charges. But, you know, they started with the CIA, and, you know, now currently they work for the CIA, National Security Agency, the FBI. They even work in civilian areas like processing taxes for the IRS, helping organize the census, working for the Homeland Security Department. So they've become this kind of all-purpose government contractor, some of which involves not just crunching numbers, but sort of the ability to help the government do surveillance on its citizens. So they've kind of branched out and become sort of this full-service national security company that not only makes weapons, but also is involved in spying and other activities.
They had the contract for Sandia Labs at one point, didn't they?
Yes, yes. They're the managing contractor for the Sandia Nuclear Weapons Laboratory. And when they, in the Bush years, they actually had their head of Sandia operations. They also are involved in running the atomic weapons establishment in the United Kingdom. So the person who handled that for Lockheed Martin went into the Bush administration as the administrator of the entire nuclear weapons complex. So it was one of the more extreme cases of the revolving door at work, because their own person now was running the complex that was giving them a couple, you know, billion dollars a year in contracts.
And talk a little bit about how Lockheed Martin has continued to grow by absorbing so many other companies along the way.
Well, particularly in the 90s, it became Lockheed Martin, merger of Lockheed and Martin Marietta, which at the time were kind of similar size. And it was actually Norm Augustine, the CEO of Martin Marietta, who was really pushing this idea. His argument was, you know, in this period after the end of the Cold War, Pentagon spending is going to come down. This is a good time to buy up a lot of companies cheaply. And then when the Pentagon budget goes up again, we'll have a much larger share of the market. So companies like the fighter division of General Dynamics, Martin Marietta itself, Loral Defense, a number of smaller companies. It ends up about two dozen companies were bought up or mergers were undertaken to create what now is Lockheed Martin. And other companies did the same. Northrop merged with Grumman. Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas. And so you had a period where you came down to maybe three or four major weapons contractors who were controlling all the big sectors, you know, be it shipbuilding, be it tanks, be it fighter planes. And so therefore the government had much less leverage, because there just weren't that many companies to turn to, and many of them were partners on some of these projects. So literally, you know, they were forced to take what they could get.
How powerful is Lockheed Martin today?
Well, I would say, you know, in many ways they're the most powerful company in the country. I mean, primarily because they're involved in national security issues. And so, you know, they get $36 billion a year in government contracts. I figured out, you know, if every taxpaying household was writing a check to them instead of to the government, it'd be $250 or more, probably more for the middle class, because, you know, there's people at the top who don't really pay taxes. And because of their across-the-board influence, you know, because they're involved not just in weapons, but in surveillance, but in, you know, all these different civilian aspects of government, that it's hard to really compare that to almost any other company. You know, just the wide range of activities, the kind of, there was a, you know, one analyst who said, you know, they're my candidate for Big Brother. You know, they're just so involved in so many aspects of our lives in ways that we don't normally hear about.
How have they benefited from everything that's gone on since 9/11?
Well, you know, the military budget has about doubled since 9/11, and their contracts likewise have about doubled. And then this is the period where they've done a lot of this branching out. They had a big contract when they were expanding the Coast Guard. They even for a while had interrogators that they were hiring to work in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. They decided that that was not lucrative enough to justify the amount of public relations problems that would come from being involved in that activity. But they were involved in, you know, training the people for the justice system in Liberia. They had a person who was on a committee that helped write the Afghan constitution. They had a group that was, you know, purportedly monitoring human rights violations in Sudan. They helped organize elections in Bosnia and the Ukraine. So they really became almost like a as if they were running their own foreign policy at a certain point.
And it's interesting that as powerful as their lobbying effort is, as a public profile, they try to keep that down.
They would prefer not to be seen in that context. You know, they would want to make it appear that they're getting everything on the merits, not because they're twisting arms. And there's a couple ways they've dealt with it. One is they fund a lot of right-wing think tanks, which sort of make the case for them. You know, places like the Heritage Foundation, the Lexington Institute, the National Institute for Public Policy, the Center for Security Policy, all these places, they support maximum spending on missile defense, an aggressive nuclear posture, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all policies that benefit these companies, but the companies are standing in the background. You know, they're funding these groups who are really making the case that otherwise they might want to make themselves, and it would look more, much more like they were just feathering their own nest as opposed to pushing for policies that are the best policies for defending the country.
What about campaign contributions? How powerful is that?
Well, they're the biggest contributor within the weapons industry. You know, in any given cycle, they'll give, you know, millions of dollars. They spend even more on lobbying, which may even be their stronger suit. They've got about 90 lobbyists, who many of whom come from government. They come from the Congress and the Pentagon and the Department of Energy, which controls the nuclear warhead complex. And so, that, you know, they can get their foot in the door to advocate pretty much anything they need. And then they give to very strategically, like Buck McKeon, who runs the House Armed Services Committee, gets about $750,000 over the last couple of years from the weapons industry for his campaigns. And Lockheed Martin is his leading contributor. They've even gone so far as to McKeon's spouse is running for state office in California. Lockheed Martin's contributing to her campaign as a way to curry favor with Buck McKeon. And they've said that they're doing it because they've taken an interest in state politics. But, of course, this is the only state race they've ever funded. So it's a little bit hard to you know, swallow that.
How do other companies in the defense industry look upon Lockheed Martin?
Well, you know, there's a certain amount of envy. I talked to a consultant who does a lot of work with Northrop Grumman, and he basically said, well, they're good at getting contracts. They're not just, you know, not very good at implementing them. So there's a little bit of a kind of a gossipy aspect. On the other hand, there's so many partnerships. You know, Lockheed partners with Boeing on the F-22. They partner with Northrop Grumman on the F-35. They've worked with Northrop Grumman on a big project for the Coast Guard. So it's this strange combination of competition and cooperation amongst the companies. They've had been involved in, you know, spying scandals where companies like Boeing have been getting some of their internal documents to use against them. So it's really been it's a very unusual set of relationships. They're not exactly shoulder to shoulder at every moment, but they are. They have a common goal of keeping the Pentagon budget as high as possible.
How concerned are they with all this talk about defense cuts right now?
Well, there's a lot of concern because they were kind of counting on endless growth, and so a lot of their plans were premised on that. And now President Obama has basically said, we can't afford endless growth, so we're going to sort of level things off, but still at historically high levels. I mean, in recent years, we've been spending the most we've spent since World War II on the Pentagon. So they shouldn't be, you know, rattling the tin cup exactly, but because they have cost overruns in a lot of their major systems, because they didn't factor in reality that the Pentagon budget was not going to increase forever, they've been screaming about this. They've been mischaracterizing it as if we're slashing defense. They've been arguing that we'll lose 1 million jobs if we, you know, readjust our Pentagon spending. So there's really been, you know, probably the biggest public outcry you've seen from the companies, at least since the end of the Cold War. And it's a much different context. The end of the Cold War, Pentagon spending was cut by about a third, you know, even adjusting for inflation. Now they're talking about, you know, maybe 10 or 15% at the maximum if the automatic cuts under the Budget Control Act, the so-called sequestration kicks in. So they're really making a big deal about what is a much smaller adjustment than they've had to make at other historic moments.
William Hartung, his book is Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. It's just out in paperback from Nation's Books. Bill, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.